I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is stumping for health care reform in Pennsylvania today, but arguably Virginia is the state to keep an eye on this week because it's poised to become the first state to make it illegal to require individuals to purchase health insurance, something President Obama says is a key part of bringing down the high cost of health care and is, right now, a requirement in proposed legislation in Congress. And it's not just Virginia. More than 30 other states are considering banning the so-called individual mandate. Rosalind Helderman is the Richmond reporter for The Washington Post. And, Roz, is this ban a done deal in Virginia?
Well, it does look like it's likely to happen. Here in Virginia, we're in the final week of our annual legislative session. The legislature here, one chamber is controlled by Democrats and the other by Republicans, and they have both already passed this bill. It's on its way to our new Republican governor, and he has indicated he plans to sign it.
Well, and tell us the thinking behind it. You have quotes from several legislators there.
This is part of this broad national debate over whether an individual mandate would violate the U.S. Constitution, that it would be going too far by the federal government to require individuals to enter into private contracts. But I think beyond that, what has gone on here is there is a sense amongst these local politicians that they think that Virginia is against this federal bill, and they think that they can kind of go on record saying so are they by passing this bill at the state level.
Well, and they're pushed in that direction by many Tea Party activists. There was a huge rally in Richmond last month, but Democrats, as well as Republicans, we understand there in Virginia, are considering voting for this ban on mandating individual purchase of health insurance.
Yeah, the bill came out of the Democratic-controlled Senate. Five Senate Democrats crossed party lines and backed it this season. You're right, there's a very active Tea Party movement in Virginia. They brought more than 1,000 people to Richmond to lobby mostly on this bill a couple weeks back. But it's also important to remember that Virginia has been one of the real new swing states, battlegrounds, going back and forth between the two parties. And the Democrats just lost the governor's mansion in November by more than 17 points and are split internally about what they should do about that.
What is the answer to the constitutional claim? You quote people like Senator Fred Quayle, a Republican, saying, "Never in the history of this country has Congress mandated that all the citizens of the U.S. purchase anything." But we're reading elsewhere, Senator Mark Warner responding to that by saying that that's nonsense. The federal government mandates Medicaid and Medicare. It's a state run, but the federal government enforces it, and states require that drivers purchase car insurance. So what do constitutional experts say to you?
Well, you know, there are some on both sides. There are probably more on the side of Senator Warner, but there are certainly constitutional experts who believe that this that an individual mandate for health care would be different. For instance, different from the auto insurance requirement, because auto insurance is a requirement if you want to have a driver's license and drive on public roads. But you don't have to have a driver's license and drive on public roads. The mm-hmm. difference with the individual mandate is it would be a requirement that, you know, as an American citizen, you need to have health insurance. So if this bill were to become law, I think it could well end up in court, and it would be for a judge to decide.
Well, Democrats in Washington feel they have the constitutional power to regulate this under the Commerce Clause, which gives Congress the power to regulate commerce among several states. But during Clinton-era health care reform in 1994, the Congressional Budget Office said the federal government hadn't ever mandated that individuals purchase any good or service. So what's the sense there of how this might spread across the country?
Well, I think that, you know, getting out of the legalities of it, what it is right now is a huge political issue. And you mentioned the number of states that are considering similar legislation. I mean, I'm not sure that those states are necessarily passing this because they want it to survive in court. I think they are passing it because they want to make a public statement about where they stand on the federal efforts on health reform.
Well, Michael Cranish of the Boston Globe writes that this sets up possibly the biggest states' rights battle since the civil rights era, and of course Virginia had a history of fighting federally ordered racial integration of the 50s. That was known then as the massive resistance in Virginia. Is this that fight all over again?
Well, I think it would depend who you talk to about this. It's interesting, if you go to a Tea Party rally, they talk an awful lot about states' rights, but they obviously don't compare themselves to those who are engaged in massive resistance. They compare themselves to American revolutionaries.
Rosalind Helderman, the Richmond reporter for The Washington Post. Roz, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, today in Glenside, Pennsylvania, President Obama addressed Republicans directly on health care reform, saying, "You had 10 years, what happened?" But there's another reform issue climbing back front and center, financial reform. And a Pew Research poll shows Democrats may have an easier sell here. Two-thirds of Americans hold an unfavorable view of banks and financial institutions. But if that's the case, what's the holdup? The House passed a bill in December which included a consumer financial protection agency that could force banks and credit card companies and mortgage lenders to reduce fees and interest rates and be consumer friendly. Congressman Barney Frank headed that effort as chair of the House Financial Services Committee. Well, he joins us now. And Congressman Frank, what is going on? Last week, we heard that the Consumer Protection Agency may fall by the wayside since Senator Chris Dodd proposed scrapping the idea and making a deal with Republicans to give those same powers to the Federal Reserve. Now, last week, you said that's a bad joke, but reports said it might happen. So what's going on here?
Well, what's going on is one more manifestation of the extent to which the filibuster in the Senate makes it hard to govern responsibly. Senator Dodd very much agrees with what we've done. He's for an independent consumer agency, but he confronts this problem of the Republicans threatening the filibuster bill. So what's going on are these negotiations in the Senate. But what I've done is to say we will have a House bill that I think is a good one and that certainly has an independent consumer financial agency. The Senate may pass a bill that weakens that because of this filibuster. My insistence then would be that we have a House-Senate conference. We will then meet, and I plan for that to be very public. And if Senate Republicans want to use the filibuster to kill an independent consumer agency, which is the bank's number one wish, then let's see them stand up and try and do that in public. I think if we force them to do that in public, they're going to back down.
Well, what about some of the other aspects of reform? We still see credit default swaps in the news. In fact, reports that Wall Street almost brought down Greece with credit default swaps.
Well, the bill hasn't passed yet, Robin, so of course nothing has changed. Mm-hmm. If the House bill had been in place, that would not have been possible to the extent that it was. For instance, AIG was brought down by issuing credit default swaps, which are a form of insurance against a drop in the price of other people's securities, that they couldn't back up. Our bill would prevent that from happening in many ways. First of all, and this I think is the most important, we are in this situation in part because of the process known as securitization, whereby people make loans, and then instead of waiting to be repaid back by the borrower, they sell the right to be repaid. We're not going to allow people to sell 100% of the loan. They're going to have to keep a piece of it. With regard to derivatives, AIG would not be allowed under the bill that we passed to sell so many insurance policies, in effect, called credit default swaps, without having the capital to back them up if they had to pay them off.
And by the way, credit default swaps, we throw some of these terms out. They're still hard for a lot of people to wrap their head around. I heard you make a description of a credit default swap, this sort of thing that's like insurance but not regulated.
A credit default swap is insurance that AIG sold to people that says if the value of mortgage-backed securities, packages of mortgages that were securitized, as I said before, if those go down in value, we will pay you the amount that they went down in value. Now, AIG was able to do these because they're a new thing, so they weren't regulated. So what happened was AIG insured a lot of people that their mortgage-backed securities wouldn't drop in value. They didn't worry about paying off because they thought they never would have to pay off. As you heard me say, it was kind of like people deciding they were selling life insurance to vampires. And then the vampires died. The mortgage-backed securities, because of the collapse of the housing market, lost value, and AIG then had to make good on insurance policies and didn't have the money to make good, and that's what caused the collapse.
And of course, vampires are never supposed to die,
right?
Like the mortgages were never supposed to go down.
But our bill would, in the first place, prevent a lot of the bad loans from being made. We would require the derivatives to be put on exchanges, credit default swaps to a form of derivatives, so people would know, wait a minute, you're selling me this insurance and you can't back it up. And finally, we have a council of regulators in both the House and the Senate bill, the Senate bill still pending, which would be monitoring. Right now, nobody was watching AIG to see if they were getting in trouble. In the future, there will be somebody looking at that and would have stepped in and said to AIG, oh, you're way overexposed. You have sold far too many of these things and you can't pay it back. In fact, even before they reset, and it would have said to them, you cannot sell any more until you raise a lot more capital.
Well, Congressman Frank, as we said, this is where a lot of Americans are applauding Democrats. Polls show that. Do you think, first of all, the administration made a mistake in not pushing harder on financial reform first before health care reform?
I do now. I want to be honest. I didn't think so at the time. There's a little bit of hindsight. It would have been better now, I believe, for President Obama in his first months to say, okay, look, we have got to show people that if we come together through what we call government, things can work. And yes, it now does seem to me we should have stressed that. I'll give you an example of just the political side of it. In December, when the House finally passed the bill, we had a vote in the House and the Republicans offered a motion to kill literally every single financial reform. And every single Republican voted for it. I think if the American people understood that, they would have been very disappointed in that position. But it came in the midst of the health care debate. So, yes, there's been more focus on health care than on this. And from the purely political standpoint, I think that was a mistake.
Well, not only that, it seemed to get wiped off the papers by the Christmas plane bomb suspect,
exactly,
which
right.
came
yes.
just after that. Well, now there's a lot of anger at Democrats because of banks being bailed out. So it's not only that you may not be getting credit for something that Americans seem to, at least by the polls, be in favor of, but they're also blaming you, Democrats, for the bank bailout.
Well, that's probably our fault. It's probably the media's fault. The media is, after all, we were passing that. There was nothing stopping the media from talking about this. That was partly the White House, but the media is free, obviously, to pick its own statements. As to the bailouts, one of the things that I think people have lost sight of, and maybe we should have stressed it more, every single activity of the federal government that's called the bailout, money to the banks, money to AIG, money to General Motors and Chrysler, it all came under George Bush. Every single one of those was initiated by the Bush administration. We worked all much of last year on this financial reform, and I do regret that it wasn't focused on it. I've had people say to me, how come nothing's happened on financial reform? My answer is, well, the House passed a very good bill. It just hadn't gotten a lot of attention.
Well, do you think that your proposal for this tough, transparent talks on financial regulation in the coming months could turn around some of the anger that's
yes.
now directed towards Democrats?
Well,
you do.
I don't know what it does. Look, that my job is to do the right thing, public policy. I guess I would say this. I think if people knew more of what was happening, yes, there would be more support for what we're doing. And that's not the only reason for having the transparency, by the way. Part of it is that if we have the process I'm talking about, a full, open debate, we'll get a better bill because there are things that some of these people would like to do to consumers and investors quietly that they may not have the courage to do if they have to do them in public.
Well, I was asking if you think this is going to help Democrats in November, but the other question is, do you think it's not too late? I mean, we were hearing last week, it sounded as if your proposed consumer agency was dead, that the Fed was already taking it over.
No, that's in the Senate. People, Robin, if you'll forgive me, that's an example of the media misreporting. The House has passed a bill that set it up. I read a lot of those stories. None of them mentioned, or most of them didn't mention, that the House had already passed that bill, and we have the ability to insist on it. People acted as if, oh, once the Senate does it, that's all. By the way, Senator Dodd had his way. He'd write a bill very much like ours, maybe even better, as I would if I had it all by myself. He may have to give in some to the Republicans, but if they have to do this publicly, then I think it will turn around.
Democratic Congressman Barney Frank, chair of the House Financial Services Committee. Congressman Frank, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Okay, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, Dr. Paul Farmer of Partners in Health, what has to happen now for Haiti, especially since the spotlight has moved to Chile? And later today, a federal plan that could help homeowners cut back on their fuel bills but also produce more jobs, at least it already has in Maine. That's later today. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. Rene Preval, the president of Haiti, is due in Washington today to meet with members of Congress, and then on Wednesday, President Obama. The Inter-American Development Bank estimates that the cost of rebuilding Haiti will be nearly $14 billion, and Preval hopes this week to convince the U.S. to add to its $700 million commitment. The numbers are staggering: 220,000 dead, 1 million-plus homeless, and with virtually no medical infrastructure left standing after January's earthquake, 300,000 injured. Paul Farmer is co-founder of Partners in Health, a Boston-based nonprofit which has been working in Haiti for nearly 30 years. He's also a professor at Harvard Medical School and a volunteer UN Deputy Special Envoy to Haiti. He joins us from New York, where he's preparing for an upcoming international donor conference for Haiti. That's on March 31st. And Dr. Farmer, Paul, you've been back and forth to Haiti several times. What's the situation there now?
Well, the situation, as everybody knows, is grim, and there are some problems that are bigger than others. Whereas maybe 6 weeks ago you'd say that food and water and shelter and sanitation for the displaced were the biggest problems in terms of response in that second window after the initial relief and rescue. I think today we can say that shelter and sanitation have emerged as the leading problems. So you've got over 1 million people who are basically homeless, and I think some people think they're in tent cities, but most of them are not fortunate enough to be in tents at all, rather under pieces of tarp or even sheets and tin. And that's going to be the biggest challenge, I think, between now and when the rains really start. And they've already started.
Yeah. What about the distribution of all sorts of aid? We're hearing that most of it is going, the bulk of it is going to Port-au-Prince. How does that impact your work?
Well, the biggest problem is in Port-au-Prince and south. You need to look at, you know, the entire country, that much is sure, because if you had massive population movements to the north, particularly to the Artibonite, central and northwest provinces, then you need to follow those people and provide them services, whether you call them internally displaced persons or whatever. They need services. So it has to be national. But I think there's an even bigger problem than the concentration of resources in Port-au-Prince, and that's the concentration of resources in the hands of those who are not providing enough jobs to Haitians. So there's kind of a problem just even getting the money out into the hands of those who need it most. If the rules of the road are rewritten so that people receiving money for Haiti have to make sure that the majority of that money actually goes to job creation for Haitians whenever it's possible, that would be a major shift. In other words, we have more NGOs per capita in Haiti than any other country in the world right now. And yet we're not able to get all of those resources out expeditiously. Why is that? And part of it is we have to really insist that job creation for Haitians is in and of itself a social goal when there's a 80% unemployment. So I think these are things we can tweak the system to make it work better for the Haitian poor. And if people have jobs, obviously they don't need food distribution necessarily. They can buy their own food. And there are lots of positive spin-off effects of job creation that I think are under-acknowledged, really, in the NGO community.
Well, I was thinking that one of them might be that Haitians wouldn't view themselves as a victim society.
I mean, I know that Haitians often will talk about their long struggle against slavery and as what started this very difficult relationship between Haiti and the rest of the world throughout the 19th century and on to today. But they're also, I think, regard themselves quite correctly as tough and, you know, scrappers who are all too happy to point out the things that I just did, for example. So what I'm really doing is echoing what I hear all the time in Haiti, is that you can't have all this money destined for Haiti and not see it go into job creation and basically efforts that Haitians control themselves.
By the way, how do you do that with Partners in Health?
Well, for example, Partners in Health has over 4,000 employees. It's the largest employer in central Haiti, and those are all Haitians, mostly community health workers, and most of them have never had a job before becoming a community health worker. So, again, it's not magic. It's really just insisting that the resources go whenever possible to create Haitian jobs. Another example of how we do that is to have reflected on where we went wrong in the first 10 years of our operations and how we could do better. And one of the conclusions we came to 10 years ago is we really need to fight harder to protect the public education and public health systems. So we ended up, over the last 10 years, all of our capital and infrastructure projects have all been in the public health system. Even if we build a hospital, we don't build it for Partners in Health. We build it for the Ministry of Health, and we help manage it. It's not rocket science. It's just one of the ways to make sure that Haitians can enjoy basic social and economic rights, like the right to education and the right to health care.
Well, as we said, you're in New York preparing for this United Nations Donor Conference for Haiti, March 31st. And since everyone knows, since Haiti, we've also seen the devastating earthquake in Chile. Not that I want to assign any sort of competition here, but has that affected your fundraising?
I would say that we're very much aware that any other distraction can knock people off of the Haiti tasks, which are going to be monumental and take many years to accomplish. But in terms of the relative size, and again, one hates to engage in spurious comparisons, but you know the size of the Haiti tragedy, its concentration in the heavily populated areas, the destruction of almost every federal building in the country, it's really an unprecedented disaster, even if you're comparing it to the earthquake in Nicaragua in 1972, this Asian tsunami. And, you know, we have some quantitative sense of that now, that this is really the largest natural disaster to befall this hemisphere in a century. And it really needs to be understood how much more significant this is than those other disasters, because we need to make sure that our response is commensurate. And we're all going to be fighting to keep people's attention focused on Haiti and helping Haitians build back better.
Paul Farmer, co-founder of Partners in Health, also a professor at Harvard Medical School and a volunteer UN Deputy Special Envoy to Haiti, in New York this week preparing for an international UN donor conference for Haiti on March 31st. Dr. Farmer, thanks as always.
It's my pleasure, Robin.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, generous health care plans for city and town workers are pushing cities and towns to the brink of bankruptcy. Should laid-off workers get health care for life, sometimes worth $1 million? That's tomorrow. The latest news is next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Iraq, the vote count is underway to determine who will lead the country forward as U.S. troops march toward their scheduled exit from the country by the end of next year. 19 of the country's 28 million eligible voters turned out in yesterday's parliamentary elections. The BBC's Dan Damon is in Baghdad. So, Dan, what's the sense in Iraq today?
A sense of relief and a sense of achievement, Robin, really. A sense of relief that the day was largely peaceful. There were the tragedies. Around 40 people died across the country. But after a few hours with some mortars fired into the capital and into the green zone, the insurgents either ran out of readily accessible ammunition or they decided that they'd failed to disrupt the poll. And the people grew bolder. They came out. They voted in larger and larger numbers. And that's the sense of achievement. They believe that they have voted for a government. They proved that they can create a political system here, not a perfect democracy, but something certainly based on the voting of the people. And behind me, of course, you can hear the usual Baghdad soundscape of generators because the electricity is so unreliable. And then beyond that, the sound of the call to prayer. And that too really is a feature, Robin, because one of the things we're getting in the very early indications of the results, it seems that the avowedly religious parties have done less well, and certainly that matches the evidence as we went around the country. People told us they wanted an end to sectarianism.
Well, there were 6,200 candidates to fill only 325 positions in the parliament, to see which party has the majority and therefore leads. So, as you said, it's going to take a while to sort out, but how did sitting Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's party fare?
His is one of the parties which is claiming that it's done well. It certainly did well in those nine Shia provinces, majority Shia provinces. But again, as I say, it did better than one of the parties that is most clearly associated with sectarianism, and that is that that's led by Muqtada al-Sadr. You remember him as the leader of the Mehdi army who fought the U.S. forces here. And so Nouri al-Maliki, as the outgoing prime minister, he certainly is going to be a player in what will inevitably be coalition negotiations, but also the party of the former prime minister Ayad Alawi, the Iraqiya bloc, which is definitely much more secular and includes Sunnis as well as Shia, that's done well, and it's done well in Sunni areas, remembering that he is a Shia, but the Sunni areas, the hardline Sunni areas in Anbar province, where some of the worst fighting took place in 2004 and 2005, they appear to have voted strongly for that cross-sectarian group, Iraqiya. So that's what we're seeing at the moment.
Well, you mentioned the Sunnis. You're saying Sunnis did turn out. Sunnis, of course, primarily backed Saddam Hussein's government. And in the run-up to this election, many Sunni candidates, through de-Baathification, getting rid of members of the Ba'ath Party, were eliminated from the running. But you're saying that the Sunnis turned out.
They did. We went to Fallujah. We went there, and they were saying what seemed to us at the time to be remarkable, that although for them life was better under Saddam, and that they all virtually said that, they were going to vote for Ayad Alawi because they believe he will be the most resistant to Iranian influence, and that's what scares them most, that the Iranians will dominate the Shia-led government.
Dan Damon, again in Baghdad, you mentioned that there's probably going to have to be a coalition government. Do you think current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will be able to form a coalition government, given that there were, hard feelings running up to this election?
One of the things we've heard is that perhaps the big names, although they will have influence, they might have in the end to promote lesser known names for the top jobs, because that would be a compromise, and the kind of resentment that you spoke about might weigh too heavily against them if they want to lead a government supported by the majority of Iraqis. But it could take weeks, even months, to form a government here. That was the case in 2005. And one of the other concerns is that while there is that negotiation, then that might leave a power vacuum. And of course, we know that the insurgents haven't gone away.
Dan Damon, BBC correspondent in Baghdad, covering the elections there. Dan, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure, Robin. Talk to you again, I hope.
And when we come back, we'll be back on the home front to ask, can a new government program create jobs and save energy at the same time? That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back. President Obama says his new Home Star program will create jobs while saving energy. The president announced the $6 billion program last week. It gives people incentives to make their homes more energy efficient. It's a two-tier program. If approved by Congress, in the first tier, consumers could get up to $3,000 just for sealing air ducts or replacing windows and doors. The second tier of the program would give people $3,000 if they improve home energy efficiency by 20% and additional money if they improve it more. So, where do the jobs come in? Well, for more on that, we called Richard Burbank of Evergreen Home Performance in Rockland, Maine. And Richard, you've already been doing this kind of improvement for people. So how would the Home Star program create more jobs for companies like yours?
Holy smokes, it would do a lot of fantastic things. Our business has been in business for 3.5 years, and we have adopted that model of doing energy audits and then doing the retrofit work identified in the audit. It was one person 3.5 years ago, me, and now we're up to 15 people. And we're actually hiring in this economy. I just hired 2 people in the last 2 weeks, and we have some additional incentives that are starting to come out from the stimulus dollars, but they're nowhere near the kind of impact that we get from Home Star.
So you feel that with the Home Star incentives, people will be doing this, and that means maybe you hiring even more people to do the audit. So take us through, first of all, how much does your home energy audit cost? What's the average price if someone follows through? I mean, in other words, what do they get back? How much do they save?
I can speak mostly from the state of Maine, and Maine has very inefficient houses. Our energy audit starts out trying to diagnose where it's all going and finding good opportunities. Our company charges $500 to do the audit. We actually credit that toward doing the work because we do the work. And then to actually implement the improvements, most companies are implementing improvements that will pay for themselves, and they'll pay for themselves anywhere from, you know, within 6 years to sometimes 12 years if you're solving other problems that would hurt the house, like terrible moisture problems.
Well, give me an example of how something that you might do might end up being paid for down the road by energy saved.
Yeah, I'll give you an excellent example. There's a recent project that we did. It's a big Victorian. It's right in town here that uses 1,965 gallons of oil and 2 cords of wood.
And how much does that cost them?
$5,313 a year at $2.50 a gallon, and that's a very good price.
And what were their savings, you know, after you retrofitted the house?
You're looking at saving 25% of that, $1,300.
Wow.
And, you know, over 10 years, that saves $13,000.
Well, and the way the new government Gold Star program works, there's an equation, you know, there's some math to do, but people get money back, as we said, $3,000 for savings. It seems a little complicated, though. I mean, how does the average person prove that they've saved energy?
Well, they don't have to prove it, luckily. A trained energy auditor that understands this in and out has to prove it to qualify them for the program. There's an existing industry out there that does this day in and day out, so we know how to do it and we're ready to go. Therein is the job creation. It's a lot of labor that cannot be outsourced. And a lot of the materials we use are actually manufactured pretty close by, like our cellulose, which is our predominant insulation material, comes from Massachusetts.
Well, but, you know, critics say this hasn't worked that well in the past. House Minority Whip Eric Cantor said an inspector general report found that only 10% of the $5 billion that was set aside for home weatherization in the stimulus package was even used. So why will people go for it this time around?
Yeah, I just read that, and that's very interesting. But I can only tell you what I see here in Maine. Low-income weatherization is a very different animal. It's a very, very different animal. And the private market behaves very, very differently from programs targeted to spend government money through low-income weatherization. So it's like comparing apples to oranges.
Well, and that money from the stimulus package was aimed largely at low-income homes. This seems to be addressing everyone and addressing people like you who now have this incentive to go out and tell people more about this, to educate them.
Absolutely. It's a perfect leveraging of all sorts of things, because Homestar will not only deliver incentives to Main Street, it also encourages contractors to invest in buying more equipment. So that's going to help out. And we want to hire more people, and that's going to help stimulate the economy. And they're all stuff that can't be outsourced. You can't bring people in from China to crawl into these basements and crawl spaces and attics to solve these problems.
Well, and we should say in other parts of the country to crawl in the same places, but in that case it's to see how they can keep the hot air out and cool down homes. Richard Burbank of Evergreen Home Performance in Rockland, Maine, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Last night, Catherine Bigelow made film history, the first woman in the Academy Awards 82-year history to win Best Director. Her film, The Hurt Locker, also won Best Film, and she also became the first ex-wife to beat her former husband, but that's another story. We first spoke with Bigelow about the gender thing last summer. We're going to reprise that conversation in a moment, but producer Emiko Tamagawa, who had it, has these thoughts.
Catherine Bigelow was not a fan of the woman question. The many, how does it feel to be a woman in the male-dominated fields of directing, or the field of war films, for that matter? When I spoke with her last summer, she was quick to praise the work of real-life bomb disposal squads, to talk about how the film was different from all the other less successful films about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, quick to explain the title.
It basically means a very dangerous place. In other words, if I was to put it in a sentence, I would say, if this bomb goes off, we'll all be in the Hurt Locker.
But when I asked Catherine Bigelow about being a woman making a critically acclaimed war film, this was her response.
It's not anything I did. I think of myself as a filmmaker, and I suppose, I hope someday it will no longer be unique.
She has a point. Her gender shouldn't be an issue. She made a gripping film. But as Barbara Streisand said in presenting the award last night, the time has come. Catherine Bigelow's reaction last night to the question she's been asked 1,000 times hasn't changed much since we spoke.
I hope I'm the first of many. And of course, I'd love to just think of myself as a filmmaker.
I hope she's right. But I couldn't help but think of Hattie McDaniel, the woman Best Supporting Actress Monique paid tribute to in her acceptance speech. McDaniel won the 1939 Best Supporting Award for Gone with the Wind, the first African-American to win an Oscar. But it took 24 years for the second win, Sidney Poitier for Best Actor in Lilies of the Field. I hope the other Catherine Bigelows don't have to wait as long.
Producer Emiko Tamagawa, her conversation with Catherine Bigelow is next, Here and Now. Welcome back. Well, as we said before the break, Hollywood is still buzzing over David's win over Goliath at the Oscars last night, The Hurt Locker, the little film about the work of an explosive ordnance disposal unit in Iraq in 2004, was named Best Picture last night. It won out over the big blue behemoth, James Cameron's epic Avatar. The Hurt Locker was the least seen movie ever to win Best Picture, having earned a mere $12.6 million in the U.S. That's compared to Avatar's $720 million. Even the film's director, Catherine Bigelow, hadn't been optimistic.
I don't think I ever dared to hope, but I will say that what was extraordinary was the love from the critical community, and that was like wind in sails.
Well, for those of you who might have missed The Hurt Locker, and it sounds as though there are a lot of you, we thought we'd bring you the conversation Here and Now producer Emiko Tamagawa had with Catherine Bigelow when the film first came out. It began with Emiko asking Catherine what drew her to the film.
I'm definitely drawn toward characters or situations that can be very evocative and provocative and create a kind of something that I call sort of experiential cinema. In this case, with The Hurt Locker, it allows you to be put on the ground, a day in the life of a bomb tech. Boots on the ground, you are there, fly on the wall, look at what it might be like to be a bomb tech in Baghdad in 2004.
I want to talk to you about the central characters. There is William James, who is the actual bomb tech, and he's also sort of the new guy on this squad. There's Sanborn, and there's Eldridge. And it's very interesting to see over the course of the film how they develop a relationship, because right at the beginning, you can really see James is a fish out of water with his guys.
Well, he's the new guy. He's thrust into a situation because the former team leader met with a fairly catastrophic demise. And James has a very unusual combination of both a kind of reckless bravado, sort of a swagger and hubris, if you will, but with a profound skill set.
There's a scene where he has underneath his bunk parts of all these bombs that he's diffused, and it's the puzzle that seems to really, really appeal to him.
Uh-huh. This one. This one. From the UN building. Flaming car. Dead man switch. Boom. This guy was good. I like him. This one, y'all, is from our first call together. This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
Every single IED, improvised explosive device, is prototypical. There are no two alike. There's no playbook. Especially in 2004, it was a Wild West. It was the sort of dawn of bombs being the epicenter of this particular conflict. So all of a sudden, EOD, explosive ordnance disposal, is thrust right into center stage, right into the crosshairs of this war. There wasn't a ground-to-ground, air-to-ground. There's not a hill that has to be taken. It's everywhere and completely invisible. You know, in other words, all of these IEDs are disguised actually rather cleverly. So I think of him as kind of an artist, you know, looking each time at a blank canvas. How shall I treat it this time? Is it the red wire? Is it the watch strapped to the side of the bomb? Is this a pressure-activated explosive device? Is it a decoy meant to distract my attention from the real device, which is 5 feet away to my left? I think these men have the most dangerous job in the world, and yet because of the military today, it's a volunteer military. They've chosen this particular profession.
Hey, Eldridge, looks like we're going to need a charge.
Oh, I got that. Figured 4 blocks. That'll give us about 20 pounds of bang total.
That blast is going to roll straight out there. The shell will probably kick out there. Most of the shrapnel's going to shoot straight up in a beautiful umbrella pattern.
Yeah.
We're going to get some smaller pieces and shell fragments this way, but we'll be okay if we're behind the Humvee. You bring the bot back and we'll load it up?
No problem.
The screenplay was written by Mark Boal, who wrote In the Valley of Elah. That was one of the films, and there have been a number of films that have addressed the Iraq War. A lot of those films, for a lot of reasons, haven't done well. Some people thought, is it too soon, or, you know, are they trying to, you know, tell us too much? I mean, when you address a subject like the Iraq War, how do you make sure, you know, in a fiction film that you tell a story that people still want to see?
Well, I think that, although I think it's a really extraordinary movie, Valley Vella, but I think that, like many of the films that have somewhat similar subject matter, a reintegration into the home front from the effects of this particular conflict. And I think where The Hurt Locker is, it makes a kind of departure, is it's a combat movie. Our desire was to get in theater for specifically bomb techs in Baghdad in 2004 to really make it concrete. Unless you're a member of the military or maybe in the front lines or even have firsthand knowledge of an EOD tech, you don't really understand what a day in their life might be like. And they're not there as aggressors. They're there to save lives. You know, they're there to render safe these devices. And in doing so, hundreds, if not thousands, of lives are saved. And all of a sudden, you're kind of in brand new territory.
I wanted to ask you just a couple of questions about you as a filmmaker, because one thing I'm, you know, in reading about you is realizing that you came to filmmaking from the visual arts, which made me think of one scene that just took me aback when I was watching it. And it was when I believe James was defusing a bomb, and it's very close in, and he's very closely working on it. And then it pulls back. And as it pulls back, you start to see all the parts and the magnitude of it. And it is both beautiful and terrifying. But do you think your background as an artist sort of shapes you as a filmmaker when you...
I think for sure it shapes me. It certainly, I don't think I would even know how to begin to approach a scene like that if I didn't have it. It certainly helps me break it down to have had the visual art background, because it allows me to sort of focus almost exclusively on story and character. I think the visuals come fairly naturally, and so that allows me a lot more emphasis on character, which I think is where all good stories reside.
I wanted to ask you about a particular scene. There's this Iraqi who's been sort of made into an unwitting suicide bomber, and James is trying to defuse, and he's shouting, everybody's shouting. It's this chaos.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it.
I do.
I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
Let off me.
You hear me? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Get down.
That was a very emotional sequence to shoot. The Iraqi actor actually was a refugee from the occupation. In fact, he actually was a fairly well-known stage actor in Baghdad. So the opportunity to act again, he was very, very excited. He's so talented, has such a magnificent face. But we shot that sequence, and at the end of the day, when I said wrap, everybody usually, on any given natural normal day, would grab their equipment and head for the hotel. But everybody was dead still, and they all had, you know, tears in their eyes. It was a very, very, very moving shoot, that sequence.
Some soldiers have seen this film. Can you talk just a little bit about how they've reacted?
I've had extraordinary reactions. In fact, we showed it to the EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal community. And basically, I mean, the members that I've spoken to, they sort of felt like every other sector of the military has had their film. Like you've had a Navy SEAL film, you've had Top Gun, you've had this and that. But EOD has never had their moment on the screen. And if there was ever a moment, as a result, sadly, of this conflict, this is their moment.